Oh, did I? Hazel was starting to feel embarrassed at all her clumsy attempts to gather information. I don't remember. I was drinking quite a bit. I know the feeling, he said, suddenly patting his jacket pockets. I have something for you, you know. He located a folded piece of paper, one of those old-fashioned slips for jotting down messages. Frankly, I'm a little tired of this guy tying up the phone lines. Hazel unfolded the note. Urgent, for Hazel Severy, from Professor L. F. Richardson. Message. George C. Page Museum Theater at 3 p.m. Saturday, November 14. Please come alone.
Professor Richardson?
You know him. Hazel now wished she hadn't shredded that earlier note.
Did he leave his number?
No, he was way more interested in getting your cell number, which we didn't give him. Hazel's head began to ache.
Fritz?
Huh?
How did Richardson know I'd be in town?
Oh, well, he was very persuasive, and he did say he was a good friend of Isaac's. Did I forget to mention that? He also had some kind of accent, in case that's relevant.
Fritz coughed.
Page Museum? Isn't that the tar pits?
Yeah.
Maybe I should go with you, in case he tries to push you into a bog.
Hazel frowned and dropped her voice to a near whisper. I maybe remember what I wanted to ask you on Halloween.
The truth was that she didn't know until it came out of her mouth.
How do you think Isaac died?
Fritz's expression changed to one of surprise.
He let a few seconds go by before answering.
Maybe he was very sad and none of us could see it. That can happen, but...
He frowned.
There was always more going on with Isaac than he let on. Don't you agree, Hazel?
That night, back at her brother's house, after a quick search on his computer, she found the only professor by the name of Richardson with whom her grandfather might have been acquainted. Louis Fry Richardson. From what Hazel could gather, he was quite famous and had several fan pages of the nerdy, poorly designed variety. He was an English mathematician meteorologist and a pioneer of mathematical weather prediction, an ambitious field with as yet lackluster results. Richardson was also an early pioneer of chaos theory, along with meteorologist Edward Lorenz, the latter of whom coined the ubiquitous term butterfly effect to refer to minuscule events having far-flung consequences. An insect twitches in China, weeks later, a man's hat blows off in Bermuda. Yes, this was exactly the kind of person her grandfather would have befriended, and exactly the kind of man who would be interested in Isaac's most recent work. Save for one detail. Louis Fry Richardson had been dead for 60 years.
Chapter 16. The Leave.
Dear Professor Severy, please accept my sincerest condolences on the loss of your daughter. Though I never had the pleasure of meeting Sybil, I have no doubt that she was as remarkable a person as her father and grandfather. True brilliance, after all, is a hereditary monarchy, as I think someone brilliant once said. I cannot imagine the extent of your pain, but please know that you and your family are in my thoughts. Perhaps you find my concern somewhat odd considering that we have not, in fact, properly met, and that our most recent meeting was suspended. But I had a great fondness for your father, and that fondness extends to the entire Severy family. Do not hesitate to let my office know if there is anything I can do to be of service to you during this very sad time. I say this without any hope of gain, but simply as an unlikely friend. Sympathies. P. Booth Lyons. The note irritated Philip Moore each time he read it. It had been written on fine letterhead with the precision of one clearly devoted to the art of cursive. As his eyes passed over the lines, he could almost picture Nellie taking dictation at her desk, her boss pacing in front of her with all the self-importance of a big game hunter, the dough of his neck rising over his Oxford collar. I had great affection for your father. No, strike that. Fondness for your father. Did you get that, Miss Stone?
You know nothing about my family,
Philip muttered, crushing the paper and tossing it onto a growing pile of cardstock on the far end of the dining room table. It was obvious that Lyons wouldn't stop until he got whatever he was after. But Philip no longer cared. On the near end of the table, among languishing flowers, sat a growing heap of envelopes. Most remained and would remain unopened. Sympathy cards were all necessarily alike, a form letter in which modifications were allowed only for proper names and flattering adjectives. And while Isaac's condolence cards had been filled with an assortment of descriptors, brilliant, towering, generous, funny, kind, it seemed that Sybil's were all variations on a theme. Lovely, luminous, glowing, exquisite, enchanting. P. Booth Lyons had been the only one to suggest that Philip's daughter had been anything other than an ordinary girl in an extraordinary body. That she had been, in fact, remarkable. Since Sybil's death a week before, Philip and Jane had scanned their mental horizons for someone to blame. But the only candidate they could come up with was Philip's paternal grandfather for having bought the Hollywoodland plot back in the 1950s, and then installing a precipitous flight of concrete steps down which a parasomniac could fall and break her neck. Philip decided not to dwell on the irony of his grandfather having been a successful structural engineer at JPL. The police, of course, had thoroughly interrogated Jack, more out of routine than any serious suspicion. But the investigative follow-up stalled when Jack had a psychotic break after Sybil's funeral and had to be hospitalized. Drew, who had yet to be told of her mother's death, had been transferred to Philip and Jane's care until her father could be released from Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. But because neither of them was in any kind of emotional place to take care of a small child, Jane's sister Thay was flown in from Phoenix to live with them indefinitely. She immediately transformed herself into a substitute housewife and therapist, alternating her time looking after Drew and comforting her grieving sister, all the while making endless pots of tea and trays of baked goods. Faye repeatedly soothed the little girl with the fib, "Mommy and Daddy needed to go home for a little while, but they'll be back for you." If Jack wasn't better soon, Philip and Jane would have to correct this lie themselves. They would also have to look into enrolling Drew in a local kindergarten, or more suitably, the first grade. But Drew being Drew, she besieged everyone around her with questions. "Am I being punished? Was it because I ate the poisonous plant? Was I very bad?" she asked repeatedly. Faye assured her that it wasn't her fault and that her parents loved her, but Drew remained unconvinced. Yesterday, the day of the funeral, she had stopped asking questions altogether and now sat mutely on the couch with her Audubon guide open in her lap. That morning, Philip had caught her whispering an alphabetized list of birds. Catalegret, cave swallow, cedar waxwing, cerulean warbler, chestnut-backed chickadee. But mostly she was silent and still, leaving the couch only when it was time to eat or go to bed. Philip understood, of course. He and his wife had been operating on a variation of this same routine all week. Silas and Sydney were taking a brief hiatus from their practice for the SoCal Junior Tennis Open. Even though only Sydney had qualified for the finals, the twins practiced as an inseparable unit. Being the teenagers they were, they moped around the house for days, supremely confused about their feelings. The two had wept openly upon hearing that their grandfather had died, but their older sister's death had thrown them into a dumbfounded silence. They went to school as usual, and in the evenings quietly eyed their rackets, wondering when propriety would allow them to snatch them up again and flee to the nearest court. Jane had gone into the blackest of depressions, the kind from which she could send back only the crudest messages. "My girl, my little girl," and allude to wanting her own life to end. Not in a serious way, she insisted, but in the way a mother who loses a child will entertain. Faye responded by forcing her sister out of the house for a daily run in Eaton Canyon, leaving Drew with the twins. "One has to keep up one's interests," Faye told her, "even if the interest is gone." Philip had to admit that for all his sister-in-law's general obtuseness and materialism, she was a godsend, and he didn't know how he'd cope without her. His wife had completely shut down, and his ability to communicate with her had gone with it. Philip was pushing a pile of cards into a waste paper basket when he let the can fall to the floor. He couldn't stand the sight of another flower or card. He needed to get out of the house. Now. They both did. He abandoned the mess, grabbed his car keys, and headed to the garden to find Jane. Maybe without her sister circling, he could get her to talk to him. Maybe they could find a way at last to be of some small comfort to each other. An hour later, they were cresting a ridge overlooking the heart of Eaton Canyon when Jane turned to him. If she were our only child, I think that would be it for me. They stopped just feet away from a sheer drop of 80 feet. Philip slid his arms around his wife and held her, though not tightly enough to betray his alarm at the proximity of the edge.
Do you think people know how they're going to die? She asked.
Not being in the mood for morose speculation, he hesitated.
I mean, we're all going to die, she continued. It's already predetermined. We just don't know how it's going to happen. But maybe our subconscious is able to catch a glimpse of it somehow. Like that mathematician, the codebreaker for the Allies, what's his name?
Turing.
Right. Do you think every time Alan Turing looked at an apple, there was a shiver of recognition?
Turing, after breaking Nazi Germany's Enigma code during the war, had been harassed by the British government for being gay, or at least for not bothering to hide it. When given the choice of a prison sentence or chemical castration, he chose the latter, presumably because prison would have hampered the possibility of yet a third option. One he chose to exercise in his home laboratory one day, with only his appetite and a cyanide-laced apple. In this case, Jane was likely right. Philip could imagine Turing having watched the poisoned apple scene from Disney's Snow White, the mathematician's favorite movie, and experiencing a moment of intense recognition, as if remembering an event that had already happened.
Isn't it amazing, she continued, how he could be so unhappy, yet considerate enough to make it look like an accident, so he could spare his poor mother the heartache. I would do the same for you and the twins. Give you the gift of plausible deniability.
Can we not do this, please?
For God's sake, allow me my morbid fantasy, would you?
Philip was quiet for a moment. He stared out at the canyon, where the late afternoon sun turned the rock a fierce orange.
Well, we're not recreational chemists, for one thing, he said finally. The poisoned apple worked only because it was semi-credible that he spilled cyanide on his lunch.
All right, so where's our semi-credible accident?
I don't know. I think I feel a shiver of recognition every time I look at your sister's lasagna.
In his desperation for levity, Philip had wanted to make her laugh, but the attempt misfired. She pulled away, wicking the moisture from her eyes with the ends of her sleeves.
I don't understand, she choked. How can you be so cool? Where's your breakdown?
I have to stay sane for you. You want me to go to pieces like Jack? End up in the psych ward at Cedars?
At least I'd have company.
What do you want me to say, Jane? Our child is dead, and I'm heartbroken. I cry every day. I've taken leave from work.
I guess the meaning of the universe is just going to have to take a back seat to the death of your daughter. Your very unremarkable daughter.
Philip didn't know how to respond to this. Where had she gotten that word, unremarkable? It had been confined to his head, yet somehow Jane had intuited it. She turned back to the precipice. The sun hit the side of her face, throwing it into a frightening motif of shadow and fire orange. It was at that moment that he saw his wife's grief turn to rage, toward the world and toward him. It was true that Philip had taken an immediate leave from Caltech for the rest of the term. His colleagues had insisted. Professor Cato agreed to take on Philip's graduate seminar and supersymmetry class, while Kuchek temporarily absorbed Philip's graduate advisees. Still, the next morning, Philip got up and went to school. if only to sit in his office and stare at neglected equations on his blackboard, or walk a purposeless route through campus, even at the risk of running into people who would wonder why he wasn't at home. But he could feel Jane's anger becoming dark and heavy, and being of no use or solace to her, he didn't know what else to do with himself. Late fall was Philip's favorite time of year on campus, and despite his misery, he could still appreciate the season. People back east liked to insist that Southern California didn't really have seasons, and that autumn in particular failed to have any real meaning. There was some truth in this. But Philip enjoyed the subtle indicators that the Northern Hemisphere was tipping away from the sun. Besides the sweaters and light jackets that appeared in November, the olive trees slowly surrendered their crop to the pavement, and the few campus oaks changed color in revolt against the prevailing evergreenery. That morning, as he passed the Sloan Laboratory of Mathematics and Physics, Enid Elderberg, spiky grapefruit-colored hair, stud in her nose, waved to him from the steps, a pair of file boxes balanced in one arm. Philip found Elderberg's fashion sense a transparent stab at making pure mathematics look hip. But then he'd heard she was quite brilliant, so why the hell not?
"Philip, hi."
She fumbled with her boxes before setting them on the pavement. "We were all very sorry to hear about your daughter. If there's anything—" "Thank you, I'm fine, really." He didn't think he could handle any more pity. He was about to move on when she said, "You heard about our break-in?" "Break-in?" "Someone forced open several offices on the top floor last week, including mine." Philip only now remembered that Elderberg had been the one to move into his father's old office. His father had rarely used the space since his retirement, but he had never entirely moved out of it either.
"These boxes belong to Isaac," she continued. "I had them locked away in a cabinet, so I doubt anything was taken."
Philip peered up at his father's old window.
"Student mischief?"
Elderberg shrugged. "Who knows? Unsettling all the same. I was about to drop these at your office, actually."
"I can take them now, thanks. Sorry, with everything going on, I'd completely forgotten about clearing out his stuff."
"Please," she said, helping him gather the boxes. "I was happy to have the great Isaac Severy occupy my workspace for a time." The boxes were heavy. Philip's muscles ached just from the short walk to the parking lot. He loaded them into the trunk of his car and tried to tell himself that the forced entry was a coincidence. Nothing had been taken after all. But then, how would anyone know? He lifted the lid of the top box to reveal a collection of discolored newspaper clippings. The articles were all from Southern California papers, mostly the LA Times, their dates spanning decades. "Film producer dies in freak yard accident. Man electrocuted in pool, faulty wiring blamed. Man drowns off El Segundo Beach. Static electricity turns man into human torch. Father dies locked in own refrigerator. Family car rolls backward onto mother." Some of the articles were flagged with a red Sharpie. Isaac had been a nut for these sorts of gruesome incidents. As Philip recalled the similarly grim clippings that littered his father's house, he felt an urgent pulse travel up the back of his neck, followed by a phantom strobe of light. These auras happened more frequently now, which led him to suspect his migraines were evolving in some way, finding means to outwit his medication. He shut the trunk and ferreted his pill bottle out of the glove compartment. Philip had managed to convince his doctor to up his prescription significantly, allowing him to accumulate a decent stockpile, but his Subaru reserve would need replenishing. There was a single pill left, and as he tipped the bottle over like a liquor shot, he felt the very image of an upmarket junkie, a highbrow, tweedy version of Tom. Glancing up briefly to make sure no one had seen this undignified move, he noticed a black town car with opaque windows parked in a corner of the lot, facing out. As he felt the pill slide down his throat, he was overwhelmed by the suspicion that he was being watched, and had been for days. A second later, he saw Nellie Stone in a black brim hat and sunglasses cutting across the parking lot toward the town car. Philip quickly ducked behind the wheel to avoid detection, but something made him look back in the direction from which she had come.
In the shadow of the physics building, he could make out Andrei Kuchek standing there. His colleague wore an irritated expression and clutched a pile of books to his chest as if it were armor. Kuchek took one last look in Nelly's direction, mumbled something to himself, and hurried back inside. Philip felt his anger returning. Letters from Lyons he could ignore, but these repeated intrusions into his life? Nelly had left several messages on his phone the past week, all of which he had deleted without listening to. When the town car had pulled out of the lot and was gone, Philip locked up his car and tracked Kuchek to the faculty lounge, where he poured his colleague a cup of coffee and asked him about the encounter.
What did she say, Andre? Was this the first time she's approached you?
Kuchek was typically unresponsive.
Did you hear what I said, Andre? Andre!
Kuchek dropped his pencil and answered in his strong Czech accent.
I told her you were on leave. Pushy woman. Why don't you ask her what she wants yourself? I haven't the time.
I know, Andre. Don't worry. I'll see that she doesn't bother you again. Kuchek picked up his pencil and in a rare moment of curiosity about someone not connected to his work asked,
Who is she?
Someone who knew my father, Philip said.
If you see her again, please don't speak to her.
On his circuitous way back to the parking lot, Philip found himself standing on the modernist footbridge of the Millikan reflecting pool in the fading sunlight. He wasn't sure why he'd come this way. He felt ridiculous on this tiny bridge, like a character in a storybook. He knew he should go home to Jane. He knew he should make time to have a closer look at his father's boxes. But he felt so inert, as if he were waiting for something to happen. And then it did. Philip jumped slightly at the sound of her voice.
I wanted to say how sorry I was about your daughter. I hope you got my card.
He turned. Anitka stood at one end of the bridge, wearing a saffron-yellow cardigan and striped scarf, a look more New Haven than Pasadena. And her face was strangely blank. No, unhappy. He had never seen her look sad before, and it stirred something protective in him.
I was on my way to the library. Good to see you.
Anitka. She stopped.
Your dissertation, how's it coming?
Still looking for an advisor, she said with forced cheer. I have feelers out to John Britton.
Philip felt the familiar twinge of professional envy.
And how is Great Britain taking your attack on his work?
He hasn't responded, exactly.
She began to step away.
Walk me to the library?
They started down the tree-lined path in the direction of the Athenaeum. And in a rising sensation of déjà vu, Philip realized this was the second time they had walked this way together. His preoccupation with Anitka had dimmed dramatically since Sybil's death, to the point where he was sure he had conquered his mania entirely. But he now knew that whatever Anitka had injected into his bloodstream, his recent grief was not an inoculation, just an aggravating course of antibiotics. They overshot the library. Neither of them mentioned it, and they soon found themselves in the quiet of the adjoining neighborhood.
You're lucky to live and work here, with your family so close, Anitka said.
Yours is in Ukraine?
She nodded.
I haven't seen my parents and brothers in 2 years. I tell myself I can't afford the travel, but the truth is, I can't stand the look on their faces when they see me. Sort of this desperate pride. I'm the only one who really aspired to anything, and now they expect me to be this sensation. To get rich off science.
She laughed.
It's idiotic fantasy. You're in the right place for what you're doing.
But what percentage of PhDs go on to make any kind of living? There are a few slots at Caltech for tenured string theorists and, what, a handful at a few other schools?
He gave her a sidelong smile.
Remember, those positions are for people who don't despise the reigning theory.
She waved her hand with an annoyed flourish.
That's exactly my point. Think of the few people like you who are able to make their livelihood from it. How can I possibly make a life out of introducing a rival to the dominant ideology? And even if I do finish my thesis and graduate, What then? Maybe I get a job teaching F equals MA to morons. Or I can hope for an ad. Wanted. Unemployed theoretical physicist with no marketable skills outside pondering the nature of the universe.
He had never heard her talk with such self-effacement.
You were right what you said that night, she continued. I'm just one person, he protested. Don't go,
please.
I realized last week. You've been right this entire time.
She came to an abrupt stop in front of a ranch-style house.
This is me.
She turned and stepped up the drive, slipping through a wooden gate to the backyard.
He didn't move.
How about leaving right now, Philip?
Are you coming?
She called over the fence. He briefly closed his eyes and followed.
Just visiting is all.
He walked alongside the house to the back, where a small guest cottage dominated the yard. Anitka stood facing him, her figure framed by a charming ivied trestle. She turned up the stone path to her door and unlocked it. Inside, she pulled off her scarf and left him alone to survey the place. There were a few sparkly cushions on the couch to indicate that a woman lived here, but little else. The chipboard shelving along one wall bowed under the weight of books and academic papers. Next to it was a dry erase board, doodled with the mathematical objects that populated the landscape of their discipline. In the center hovered a playful verse from a dead physicist. Age is, of course, a fever chill that every physicist must fear. He's better dead than living still when he's past his 30th year. Paul Dirac, 1926, age 23. I've always hated this rhyme. She laughed from the kitchenette.
I guess I like to live my life in a state of perpetual horror.
Shifting his attention back to the books, Philip noticed an entire section of shelving devoted to chaos theory and nonlinear dynamics, not her area of study, including a collection of his father's bound papers, flagged with sticky notes. He pulled one off the shelf and looked through its curled and dog-eared pages.
You're a fan of my father's.
What did I tell you?
Everyone says that, but this is serious.
She returned with two mugs of tea and handed him one.
I find his mathematics enjoyable, don't you?
Sure, but he's my father.
It's like reading music.
Philip smiled.
I once found a mistake, she said.
You're kidding.
Oh, a small thing. Nothing really. I thought of telling him, but then he died.
But then he died. She had a talent for being blunt while skirting a fence. Philip wandered to the far side of the room where an oval table was covered in academic papers and journals. He looked through the titles and saw all the familiar authors. Veneziano, Schwartz and Green, Nambu, Witten, Maldacena, Britton. All the monster minds who had contributed to two-string theory revolutions.
You've been reading.
Yes, and I wanted to tell you something, she said with unusual calm. I had this moment the other night where I felt like the most intractable problem would have been obvious to me had I cared to solve it.
She walked to a window and pulled open the blind, revealing a view of the grass.
I was in the yard, right here, and I heard the whistling from a teapot inside the main house. They always make tea and forget the pot is on the stove. And at that exact moment, it was like someone had just walked up and handed me a telegram.
She turned back to the table.
I was aware right then of bumping my head against my own ceiling. I knew with certainty that I am not a physicist, or at least not an academic. I have never been so certain of anything.
He had followed her to the window. It occurred to him that for once she did not seem to be putting on an act. The bluster she had been walking around with for as long as he had known her fell away. And that made her even more attractive, nearly irresistible, and he marveled at how she had once meant so little to him.
It's best that I figure this out now, right?
I think you're being hard on yourself.
He realized he was standing very close to her, and he forced himself to return to the bookshelf and the doodles. It had taken immense effort to pull away from her,
and he knew it was time to leave. That's when he noticed something. On the whiteboard, in the middle of all the multicolored donuts and other manifolds, was an alien object. A brain. More accurately, the spiraled brain with the little tail he'd come to know so well. The ink didn't look quite as faded as the other figures, as if it had been drawn more recently.
Anitka, what's this?
She stepped up beside him, her face achingly close.
I'm not sure what you're pointing at.
He turned to face her.
This symbol, where did you get it?
She smiled.
Don't you recognize a Fibonacci spiral when you see one?
He looked back at the drawing and saw that it was, in fact, the famous spiral based on the Fibonacci sequence, at least an untidy version of one. His own brain was clearly playing tricks.
It's not my best work, I grant you, she said,
blinking up at him with her large, sleepy eyes.
I should go, he said.
Without warning, she took a gasp of air and threw her hand up to her face. Philip's chest tightened, his standard response to watching someone about to cry, his wife, his children. But this time it was a strange, unbearable constriction. She let her hand fall and looked down at her tea.
Oh, God, I'm really sorry. I don't want to keep you.
She was trying to sound casual, but he saw that her lashes were damp. He didn't know if he could stand seeing one more sad person in his life right now. He was sick to death of sadness, of responsibility, of the weight of everything, and he longed for just one moment of contentment, if not outright pleasure. He stepped toward her and, setting her mug aside, put a hand on her waist. He leaned his entire body into her and kissed her. They stumbled sightless to a wall and he pressed her against it, inhaling the perfume of her, the various lotions and hair products, the faint trace of saline, the stale wool of her cardigan. As he moved his lips over her skin, he began to subtract all the superficial smells in his mind until he was left with the muted fragrance of the skin itself. He thought he had never experienced anything more delicious, this small sensory detail that was Anitka Durov's scent, and he gave in to it entirely. Chapter 17. The House. On a nearly treeless street in South Los Angeles, Gregory pulled up in front of a sun-blanched craftsman house. He was supposed to be driving to Culver City, where he had an appointment with one of the victims in a recent sex abuse suit leveled at the L.A. Unified School District. But afternoon traffic had been surprisingly thin, and he was running early. So when his car had reached the nodding pump jacks of the Inglewood oil field, he'd veered east. As he made the left turn onto Stalker Street, he could feel the hand of Isaac's universal computer making the calculations to guide his car past Baldwin Hills, Crenshaw Boulevard, and Arlington Avenue. It had been almost 20 years since he'd seen the house. That is, up until a few days ago, when he'd followed his one-time foster father here. Tom had gotten off a bus and shuffled several blocks to this spot, where he stared through the fence at his old home before the sun became too much for him. Hands clutching the back of his head, Tom quickly returned to the bus stop to curl up in a tormented ball. Though he still visited the gym and library on most days, Tom's schedule was becoming increasingly erratic, and Gregory had lost track of him several times. Gregory knew, of course, that this moonlighting of his couldn't go on indefinitely. He needed to make his presence known to Tom, to push his face into Tom's and say, "Do you know me?" He should have done it when he had him here at the house. But it was too late for that. The place was now abandoned and had for some time been tanking the surrounding property values. Garbage ringed the yard and the grass had turned the color of a soiled mattress. A high chain-link fence discouraged trespassing, but it hadn't stopped Krylon vandals from leaving their mark. Why Tom had felt the need to drag himself to this place, to the scene of his past crimes, Gregory could only guess. Perhaps it was the same reason that Gregory was here now.
Maybe they both needed to remind themselves of how and why they'd become the men they were. After pulling a pair of bolt cutters from the trunk of his car, Gregory paused on the sidewalk. Recalling the moment when he and Hazel, ages 9 and 7, had first emerged from the caseworker's van and stepped onto the curb. They had been so happy to have a new home, a house, that they hadn't bothered to take in a full 360 of the neighborhood. But then anything had been better than the endless carousel of foster homes, or worse, the hall, a county holding pen where abused and neglected children went to receive additional helpings of abuse and neglect. Gregory and his sister had endured the caprices of the foster care system for 5 years, ever since their mother had gotten sick. Cancer was all they were told, and died alone and penniless. Their father had given them the surname Dine not long before abandoning the family. And since there were no living relatives, or at least none willing to take them in, Hazel and Gregory Dine became orphans. Having been barely 4 years old during the transition, Gregory could hardly recall the before time, the fuzzy memories soon indistinguishable from the vague motherly images he invented in his head. Only one thing seemed certain as they entered the public school system and began to compare themselves with other children. Hansel and Gretel, as their peers dubbed them, were genetic trash. Gregory and Hazel's new foster parents had seemed nice at first. Tom Severy, they were told, was the son of a famous professor and was himself a teacher at a local grade school, while Carla, his wife, was a bartender and freelance decorator. The home showed little evidence of Carla's latter occupation, but she could certainly make a mean G&T for her guests. They weren't rich, but they seemed like decent enough people. They were also, as Gregory came to discover, self-medicating people, jotting off imaginary prescriptions in their heads that would end in evenings of needles, pills, and lots of lying around. For Carla, it was some kind of undiagnosed mental imbalance, bipolar disorder probably. With Tom, it was his terrible headaches that would overtake him suddenly, and if he didn't take the correct combination of drugs, he would be left immobile for days. Though, truthfully, Tom was pretty immobile whether he had a migraine or not. Once Hazel, who couldn't have been more than 8, had naively tried to present Tom with an aspirin she had managed to swipe from the school nurse, sending Tom into peals of funhouse laughter. It didn't take Gregory long to realize that he and his sister had been taken in by full-blown junkies. Apparently the social workers assigned to their case had been blind to all the clues. So taken were they by Tom Severy's impressive academic bloodline. They had been equally ignorant of the couple's friends who hung around the house at odd hours, or that the front door was left unlocked day and night. But then, with an excess of orphans in the system, perhaps the state hadn't bothered to look too closely at the couple who were oh so eager to take a pair of older, unadoptable children off its hands. You want the kids long-term and you won't separate them? They're yours. And then the foster care checks began to arrive in the mail, and Tom never did go to that teaching job they'd heard about. Turned out he was only an occasional substitute anyway. And that professor so lauded by their caseworkers? He never appeared. Neither did the rest of Tom's family. But Gregory and Hazel didn't know what normal was supposed to look like. Their foster parents were careless, sure. They didn't always feed them on time or buy them clothes or give them anything other than a couple of twin mattresses on the floor to sleep on, but they weren't intentionally cruel. Not at first. Near the back of the house, Gregory used the bolt cutters to penetrate the fence and slip through. The backyard was in a similar state of neglect, but a large, healthy fig tree at least still presided over the scene. Gregory had loved the tree. It had been the pride of the house, bearing summer fruit that he and his sister would devour. They would scoop out the fig's soft bellies and chew on the peels. Now the tree gave him the creeps. Should have brought an axe. But then who can blame a tree for the sins of the house? Gregory circled the trunk until he found a hefty branch on which a rope swing had once hung. The swing had long since been cut down, but two pieces of frayed rope still choked the bark. His sister had never used the rope swing properly. Hazel would always stand on the seat and, pushing against the trunk, rotate the swing until the old knotted rope twisted around her little body. Then she would let go, sending the swing and herself twirling in the air. But one day there had been a sharp snap, and the seat had fallen out from beneath her. The tangled cords had held fast to her body and neck, leaving her dangling above the ground, gasping for air, as if she had clumsily tried to hang herself. God knows how long she'd been there, but when Gregory found her, she was unconscious. Now he lifted himself into the tree and, with the bolt cutters, worked at both knots until they fell. Back on the ground, he picked up the pieces and studied them. To this day, if he looked closely enough at the scar in his sister's neck, he could pick out the telltale helix of this same rope. He walked to the edge of the yard, where squatters had evidently set up camp at the barbecue pit. There were empty cans, bottles, plastic plates, and a lighter scattered nearby. Gregory started a fire with some twigs and dropped the pieces of rope into it. As the flame grew, he pulled a note, hastily scribbled in pencil, from his shirt pocket. "I'm leaving Jack." Gregory's heart had somersaulted in his chest when he'd first read these words at Isaac's funeral reception. There had been the excitement of being so near to her in front of so many people, touching the tips of her fingers as she passed him the message. He'd had to wait to touch her for real, a desperate fumble in the garage 2 hours later. It wasn't an ideal affair. He knew that. Apart from the fact that they both had small children, there was the distance. They hadn't been able to see each other more than a dozen odd times since the thing began 3 years ago, the months in between supplemented with texts and phone calls. 2 years ago, when Sybil had been creating art for an upcoming show in San Francisco, she hadn't been able to see Gregory for 4 months, despite the fact that Drew was in daycare. So early one morning, on impulse, he drove 6 hours north to Sunnyvale, spending the entire afternoon in Sybil's bed, and returning that night to his oblivious wife. A few times the lovers arranged to meet halfway between their cities, at some arbitrary motel along Interstate 5. Once, with the necessary cover stories in place, they splurged on a romantic night in Big Sur. Gregory had gotten used to the infrequency of their trysts. But for some reason on this last visit, the thought of not being with her for good had become unendurable. He looked back at the note, which now made him ill. Gregory had been in love with Sybil for as long as he'd known her, since they were children. He had been in immediate awe of this fairy tale girl who looked as if she'd just emerged from a haunted wood, yet walked around Los Angeles as if she were just another person. It was only after she'd gone away, gotten pregnant and married Jack, a massive mistake, she confided to him, that she realized she loved Gregory too. She was supposed to have left her husband, just as he was to have left Goldie. That was the plan. She had concerns, naturally, about breaking up their families and about Gregory's short temper, but for that brief moment in time, she had wanted to be with him. She had been right, of course. He was an angry man. When exactly had he become this way? When had he become the person who held rage so perilously close to the surface? Gregory looked back at the house, his eyes singling out a window near the ground. It was a small, miserly pane of glass that allowed only a spear of light to pierce the darkness below. He wished he could set fire to that space, with Tom locked inside. He could imagine the resident cockroaches skittering across Tom's skin to escape the flames. Yes, Gregory's life would have looked very different if it hadn't been for the germ planted so early. A seed nurtured with a steady compost of maltreatment and indifference. It was Tom, not Sybil, who deserved to die. Gregory held the lighter to the note until it caught fire. He dropped it into the pit and watched spirals of smoke pull themselves up and up, turning paper and rope into anonymous airborne particles. When the flame died and the smoke straightened, He stirred the ashes with the bolt cutter until there was no evidence that these objects had existed at all. Chapter 18. The Dead Man. On the Saturday she was to meet the man with the dead professor's name, Hazel could hardly sit still or hold a conversation. This was a problem, as in the days since Sybil's funeral, Goldie had become increasingly attached to her. Wherever Hazel was in the house, her sister-in-law sought out her company, desperate for dialogue with someone other than a 2-year-old. Gregory was gone every day, slipping out for work before Hazel got up, and returning home close to midnight. This was just the way of things, Goldie explained over daily cocktail hour therapy. He's so overworked. Her sister-in-law's frustration at having married someone who couldn't talk about his job came out in ever-increasing doses.
And who could expect him to after what he does all day? Goldie asked. But where does that leave me and Lou?
This is the life I chose, I guess. Hazel listened and tried to appear sympathetic, not letting on that the deep furrow between her brows was for her brother, not Goldie. What surprised Hazel most was just how much she enjoyed spending time with her nephew. With each passing day, as she learned to play Lewis's games and decode his peculiar chatter, her protective feelings toward him magnified. But she suspected these were less maternal instincts, and more a creeping fear connected to that fatal dot on the map. During the first week of her stay, Hazel had woken up in the middle of the night with a deep anxiety about that third dot. She hadn't remembered dreaming about it, but she had found the sudden need to see it. Slipping into the laundry room, she found the iron and began to gently steam the 2 stubborn paper dots apart. When they started to loosen, she pulled up an edge with a pair of tweezers. Slowly, the figures beneath revealed themselves through bits of adhesive. 11-01-15-00-11-46. Though the ink was a bit smudged, these numbers were nearly identical to the first dot. November 1st, just after midnight, the time of Sybil's death. At first Hazel felt relief, taking comfort in the idea that Isaac had simply pasted over the smeared digits with a more legible version, in which case there was no danger of another Beechwood Canyon death. But if this dot was redundant, where was the third death promised by her grandfather? Hazel wasn't about to monitor the entire family's movements, but she felt a supreme unease stalking up on her, like the growing momentum of a sinister machine. Besides this, she felt completely snared by indecision. She knew that if she didn't get back to Seattle soon to pick up the sodden pieces of her business, the guttersnipe was done. But what about this invitation from a self-described friend of Isaac's? What about the hotel room? Having already visited room 137 again, there seemed nothing left for her to do there, though the front desk called her daily. Having given the hotel her phone number, she received multiple voice messages inquiring how they might contact Mr. Diver now that his phone had been disconnected. A clerk claimed there was new demand for the space and requested an early deposit for December of $2,700. Well, that certainly explained Isaac's bank statements. "Will he be paying in cash as usual?" the clerk asked. She didn't know what else to do but stall with false promises to pay. At 2 o'clock on Saturday, an hour before Professor L.F. Richardson would be waiting for Hazel at the La Brea tar pits, Goldie suggested they take Lewis to the beach. Hazel begged off the trip, making a lame excuse about having to meet an old friend.
"Oh," Goldie said, visibly disappointed. "Can I drop you somewhere?"
"No, no, I'll drive," Hazel said, grateful that she'd had the foresight to take Isaac's Cadillac on the day she fled the Beechwood house. When Goldie's Prius was gone, Hazel locked up and started in the direction of the Cadillac. Competition for street parking had been fierce, and she'd had to leave it under the shade of a magnolia 2 blocks from the house. As she was about to cross the street, she stopped short. A man sat in the driver's seat, his face obscured by the reflection of trees and sky. She stepped behind a street lamp, her heartbeat increasing. Had this L.F. Richardson found her? But when she took a second look, she recognized the hands tightly gripping the steering wheel. It was her brother, She crossed the street and rapped on the passenger side window, but Gregory looked up with such fright that she was immediately sorry. He rolled down the window, his alarm turning to irritation.
You know I hate being snuck up on. Why are you smiling?
I'm really sorry, she said. It's just weird finding you here.
This isn't your car, he said coldly. You can't just take things.
Hazel was so puzzled by his anger that she didn't respond. She climbed into the car, not daring to ask what the hell he was doing there in the middle of the day. She suddenly remembered a French film she had seen years ago about a guy who just stops going to work. He would make a show each morning of putting on a suit and eating breakfast with his family, but then just wandered the city all day, having a slow and spectacular breakdown. She noticed a half-empty liquor bottle at her feet. You never drink, she said, picking up the bottle. Cutty Sark.
Yes, well.
He gestured in a vague way, his mood suddenly leveling.
I thought I'd try letting myself go, see if it's as relaxing as it looks in the movies.
You could go back to the house, she suggested gently. Goldie took Lewis to the beach. He let a few seconds tick by.
I know how it looks, Hayes.
Tell me, because I really don't know.
Everyone's been out of it since the accident.
Why did the word accident suddenly sound like a euphemism? So this is because of Sybil? She asked softly. He didn't answer, just took the bottle from her hand. She thought of the expression she had seen on her brother's face the morning Sybil was found. A look of smothered pain. How odd that Gregory knew about Sybil's fight with Jack, as if he'd made it a point to know such things. Hazel always suspected that her brother had a thing for Sybil, but after he got married, she'd put the idea out of her mind. When they were young, of course, it had been Gregory who had sought out Sybil's company, despite the fact that she was a few years younger. It was Gregory who had always managed to find an excuse to be where she was. Hazel thought he might take another swig of whiskey, but instead he set the bottle in his lap, reached across the seat, and took firm hold of her hand. You know you can talk to me, Eggs. He gave a barely perceptible nod and continued to look straight ahead. They hadn't held hands like this since they were children, since that one night long ago when sister and brother, ages 9 and 11, had sat outside their home watching a pair of LAPD officers carry off their foster father. Hazel had been half reclined on a stretcher, a bandage around her neck wrapped by paramedics after they'd brought her back to consciousness. Gregory sat beside her on the ambulance bumper. In the confusion before Hazel was taken to the hospital, no one had thought to shield the children from the spectacle of Tom's arrest. As Tom was led across the lawn, Hazel gripped her brother's damp hand and watched Tom scream and spit in their direction.
Carla and I took you in, you little shits, saved you from that county hellhole, and this is what you do! You have no clue what it's like to live in my head, no fucking clue!
After being pushed into a squad car, he stared out at them with frenzied, questioning eyes, as if suddenly trying to puzzle through why he was there. Tom was there, of course, because the police had just discovered an arsenal of drugs in his basement, and the body of his opiate-addicted wife in a basement tub. The autopsy would reveal that Carla had not, in fact, died of an overdose, but of dehydration. Her blissed-out body, planted beneath a working faucet, had given out for lack of water. In Tom's narcotized days, he had either not noticed his wife's body or decided he wasn't in any hurry to report it. It was Gregory who had coolly dialed the paramedics from a neighbor's house, but only because he'd found his sister suspended in a tree that afternoon, her neck in the serpent's grip of a rope. The paramedics in turn called the police. Child abuse, drug possession, foster care fraud, failure to report a body, manslaughter, if not murder. Hazel touched her neck, but she wasn't thinking of her scar or of the stories she sometimes invented about it to shut down questions. She was thinking of Gregory's twin horror story. Far worse. On summer break, less than a year after they'd come to live with Tom and Carla, he was locked away in a dark basement closet without water or food. What had begun as punishment for some forgotten offense turned into the trauma of his life, after their foster parents either forgot he was in there or pretended to forget. It was never clear which. Did they know that he would lie there for days without sleep, his voice hoarse from screaming through concrete? Did they consider the roaches that would come out at night to crawl across his huddled body? At 7 years old, Hazel had been too young to grasp the quiet horror that was unfolding below ground, but kept asking, "Where's my brother? Is he hiding?" Beyond searching every room, closet, and cupboard in the house, save the perpetually locked basement, she had felt completely helpless. When Gregory was finally let out, to what seemed like feigned surprise from his jailers, he gulped a soda he was given and promptly threw it up. After that, he was in bed for a week, his body covered in bruises from having thrown himself against the closet door. The human body can survive for 5 days without water. Gregory had been in that closet for 4. He eventually regained his strength, but his mood turned solemn and black. He hadn't been raped, sexually abused, or subjected to direct physical pain, but Hazel wondered later if her brother's confinement to that hole of deprivation had not, in fact, been worse. They both had endured daily miseries that in their frequency were arguably more corrosive than any one event, overhearing classmates whisper that they smelled bad, stealing food to avoid the mockery of free lunch, piling on towels at night in want of warm blankets. But it was Gregory's nightmare alone that had come to stand for those 2.5 years in that house. Why hadn't they left? Run away? Why hadn't she or Gregory told somebody? The person who asks these questions has never been an orphan. Because for orphans, all options appear equally hopeless, equally menacing. No, the monster was not coming back. Ever. They had been sitting in the Cadillac for close to 20 minutes. "I have to go," Hazel said, squeezing his hand. Gregory didn't ask why, just took a deep breath and nodded. Bottle in hand, he pulled himself from the car, slammed the door tight, and with a forced, jaunty wave, started down the block. As she slid across the cracked vinyl, watching her brother disappear around the corner, Hazel understood why he had chosen to hide out here. Whatever else was going on in his life, whatever he couldn't say, there was something about the old car that was comforting. It wasn't the most beautiful model of Cadillac, boxy and cumbersome as it was, but if nothing else, it was a time capsule, bearing with it memories of rescue and safety. When Isaac and Lily had stepped in to claim Hazel and Gregory as their own, whisking them away in this very car, how surprised she and her brother had been to discover that Tom's extended family was normal. There was the beautiful house on the hill, with plush beds and fresh linens waiting. How marvelous to find food in their refrigerator instead of shriveled vegetables and expired condiments. Although, after his closet confinement, her brother's relationship with food had paradoxically become one of strange indifference. When enveloped by such unflagging attention, love, really, it had been easy to get over her hurt, or at least to mostly forget. Had Gregory done the same? Or is that why he had joined the LAPD? Perhaps it had been on that night, as she and her brother witnessed Tom's arrest, that Gregory had resolved to become a police officer. Though he had tried in college to push his brain through the latticework of mathematics, maybe he had always known he was meant for another line of work. Hazel pulled out Isaac's keys and turned the ignition. It was 10 before the hour. She would have to hurry if she was to keep her appointment with the dead man. The thick odor of tar rose from the ground as Hazel hurried across the park to the museum. Here and there, patches of crude oozed to the surface of the grass, betraying the vast stew of petroleum and animal bones that lay beneath. She stepped in an inky puddle and had to drag her shoe along the grass for several yards. It was 10 past the hour. She was late. After paying admission and passing a sign whose sole purpose, it seemed, was to disappoint children, no dinosaurs were found in the tar pits. Hazel grabbed a map. There were, in fact, 2 theaters in the building. Richardson's message had not specified which. The first was screening a documentary with slick production values, while the second featured an educational film that looked to have been produced during the Carter administration. Hazel chose the latter, taking a seat near the door. Her heart was still beating fast from her dash across the park. Or maybe it was anticipation. On screen, a panicked cartoon horse fought back against the tar's vacuum grip, while a